This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The president is back at the White House. He issued a video saying, don't let this stop you. Let's call in the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Boy, watching the cable news shows tonight, it, of course, ranges from Fox saying that this is a man of courage and a hero who is like a general leading us into battle, and MSNBC saying that this guy can hardly catch his breath after climbing the White House stairs. He's going home an ill man. What did you think, Dr. Cohen?
You know, I have to be honest with you. I thought he looks quite good. You know, I've now seen three videos. They've all happened sequentially. And I thought in the first video, you know, he looked ill and he seemed breathless as he was talking, and he spoke for 4 minutes and he just didn't look that great. And then within 48 hours, he did the second video where he said he's gone to school on COVID, and he certainly looked a lot better. And frankly, the video that came out today, he looks really good. You know, unfortunately, Donald Trump is a polarizing figure, and I don't want medicine to be politicized. Unfortunately, it's become politicized. But frankly, he has gotten this illness. He stood out in front of the country and showed what it was like for somebody to get the illness and to recover from it. And frankly, one of the things he says resonates with me. He says, don't let the disease dominate you. And I've always had this notion. I actually learned it when I was an intern in general surgery. One of my attendings used to say, if you look like a patient, you feel like a patient. And I've always believed that to be true. And so he sort of has the right attitude, like, okay, I got this illness. I'm not going to be sick. And I'm going to push forward and get through it. And I think there's truth to that. I think your attitude has a lot to do with how sick you are or not in any given illness.
From that video, then, what's the message that people should take as far as how they should conduct themselves?
Well, I still think we need to be careful. I don't want to dismiss any of the public health issues, right? I think that we still need to social distance. I think we still need to wear masks. I think we still need to be careful. But I think the notion is, you know, we can't live in complete and total fear of getting this disease. And we still need to be able to function as a society. And so I think everything in life is about finding a balance. And I don't think we can go to the extreme of opening up and going back to the way things were as normal and having no safety precautions. On the other hand, I think we need to have the safety precautions in place, but I think we still need to live some sort of an existence. So I always think things are about balance. And for me, that's what I take away from it.
I saw the TV doctors engaged in a discussion over whether it made sense to release him right after giving him this steroid or initiating this steroid treatment, which I understand has to continue.
Well, as we talked about on yesterday's show, he really sort of had the kitchen sink thrown at him. He got a bit of everything. He got the dexamethasone, he got the remdesivir, he got famotidine, vitamin D, and he got this new Regeneron antiviral cocktail. So he really got everything. And so it's hard to know exactly what it means when somebody's given all these different therapies. But clearly, he responded well to all of them. And I don't think we really understand yet how one person gets more sick than another. Is there a genetic component? We don't know that, although there's suspicion that there is. Is it just your age or that you may or may not have, you know, other comorbid issues? Maybe. We don't really know yet. And so it'll be a long time until we know. But clearly, he was a healthy enough guy. He had the right mental frame of mind, and he got everything there was to get in terms of treatment. And so he looks good. Is that going to tell us something about how we should treat patients? I don't think so. Because, again, that's what I always warn against, which is anecdotal medicine, you know, an N of one, meaning one patient who got treated in a certain way, responded in a certain way. That doesn't mean that we should suddenly change the way we're treating everybody else. But, you know, he looks good. He doesn't look like somebody who needs to be in a hospital. He does still have the virus, and he still is capable of transmitting it to others. So he still needs to quarantine himself, and he still needs to wear a mask and practice social distancing. But I don't think he needs to be hospitalized based on what he looks like in these videos and what I've seen on TV.
So he's delivered this encouraging message. So I think people, I mean, I'd like to be able to tell people, can they expect this? If they were to come down with COVID, can they expect to be admitted on day one, treated on days two and three, and released on day four, looking like Donald Trump?
Well, let's keep in mind that the majority of vast majority of people who get COVID don't get admitted to the hospital. So let's start there. And as we talked about on yesterday's show, greater than 95% of people when you look at all comers, will survive the illness. So that means that they're going to recover. But, you know, there's still a wide range in terms of the degree of illness that you get and the severity of illness that you get within those 95%+ people who survive and recover from the illness. So, you know, he is at an age group where you would say, well, he's in an older age group. He's 74. And so that would have put him at a slightly higher risk. You know, he's overweight. He may have some hypertension or somewhat. I mean, I'm not positive, but clearly he was able to recover quickly. And what role his overall general health played, we don't know. What role his genetics played, we don't know. And what role the medications played, we don't know. That's the whole purpose of doing clinical trials. But I think in the end, he looks good. He's done well. And I think that's, you know, a win for us and, you know, a win for the country, frankly.
So just for people who say, Davey's faking it, could he have walked up those stairs and delivered that announcement if he was struggling for breath? From what you know of what it's like, because you've treated patients who've had this low oxygen saturation, could he have pulled that off if he wasn't feeling well?
Yeah, no way. I mean, as a cardiac surgeon, I mean, I see patients in heart failure, respiratory failure all the time. I mean, this is what I deal with. And so there's no way he could have. I mean, clearly he's in good shape or he wouldn't have been able to do that. Again, if you go back and look carefully at the first video he released, the one where he was sitting at the desk, he was breathless in between his words. Whereas if you look at the one today, he's not breathless at all. He actually looks quite good. That is a change in his overall physical appearance and his overall health.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Choke points.
Let's go.
So for those of you who have to wrestle with the trestle, the state would like to put some zip in your trip, but first they want to make sure that you are fine with the design. So here's Chris to tell us what that's
Wow. Like. You want to do my whole story like that?
No, it's okay.
That was actually well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, the state wants to have a new westbound trestle up and running by 2045. It would be built next to the existing trestle, providing one-way traffic on each, greatly improving the capacity on the 3.5 miles from Lake Stevens to Everett.
We know that the trestle is nearing the end of its useful life in terms of being able to accommodate traffic and community growth. And by 2045, it will be at the end of its life in terms of accommodating that.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Chris Olson says you still have time to participate in an online open house to give planners your thoughts on the corridor.
We can study it. We see the traffic. But what are the people who are actually using the trestle? What are they actually experiencing? What do they think the problems are?
Under normal pre-COVID conditions, more than 80,000 vehicles use that trestle every day. Previous studies have looked at the Lake Stevens side, environmental issues, potential funding. This open house focuses on the Everett connection to I-5.
Does it need more lanes going across? Do they think it's really about the merge onto I-5 or down into Everett? Maybe designate one of them as an HOV? Those are the things where we're just trying to gather that information to hear from the people that use it.
Olson says the top designs under construction include 3 or 4 lanes on the trestle, and she says it's really that merge with I-5 that really causes the significant issues.
A 3-lane trestle would accommodate the traffic in 2045. The problem is getting onto I-5. That's a huge issue because I-5 is at capacity now in the mornings. And so there's not a lot of room to let those people from US 2 squeeze in there.
There is a potential to take an HOV lane under the existing eastbound trestle and join I-5. Take advantage of the limited space in that area. You can check out the drawings and find a way to get to the open house at mynorthwest.com. As for the funding issues, we've talked about this one before. Tolling is being considered as a possible funding source for this project, which is expected to come in at over $1 billion.
Wow.
The tolling under consideration, similar to many tolled facilities we have in here, providing a certain amount of the price, and the price would be changed based on the time of day and the direction. So, yeah, tolling is on the table, but they're still working this thing out. The bottom line is they need to get a new trestle in there, and they really want to know what you think.
It seems nuts to toll it, though. It's the only way out, only reasonable way out, though, for people in Lake Stevens.
That is true, but in order to get it, the funding just isn't there without everything on the table. But you're right, they are kind of held hostage by that.
Because at least with 520, you've got I-90 if you want to avoid it, and it's a hop, skip, and jump away.
Yeah.
The trestle is
The thing was built in the late 60s, I think late 68, 60s. I think.
And it's not going to be ready until 2045?
Well, that's when they know it's at the end of its lifespan.
Oh, I see.
So they would like to get it done as soon as they can, but that's the back end of they want it built by then.
I see.
So that's,
that's a long pregame show.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of time to discuss tolling and how much you hate it, and not you specifically, Dave, but just you, the royal you and the public.
No, I get it. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Big question on everybody's mind, is it safe to send my kid back to school? Even if the school conducts all the proper protocols and has PPP for everybody and has social isolation, can I be guaranteed that my child is not going to catch the virus, especially considering the president now has it? Let's go to Emily Oster, who is an economics professor at Brown University, and you helped to create their coronavirus response dashboard. One of the things that's been frustrating to me is, I mean, we've got COVID trackers calling up people trying to figure out who gave it to whom. We still aren't getting very good information about how safe or unsafe schools are. So what can you tell us, Emily?
Yeah, so what we are trying to do with this tracker is we're trying to actually start by asking schools both how many kids they have enrolled, what kind of opening plan they have, and what kind of mitigation we're doing, because I think he exactly started with a good point, which is, you know, how can we know how safe schools are when you're doing them as safely as possible? And then we've been collecting that data, and then we've been following up and asking schools how many COVID cases they have. And we've been trying to track that over time and get a little bit of a sense of how risky it really is, trying to put some real numbers on the kinds of things people are afraid of.
So what can you tell us based on what you've seen? If you have proper masking, if you have testing, do you have to have daily testing? What is it that makes the difference between a school that's safe and one that's not safe?
So almost nobody's doing any testing. We're generally seeing pretty low rates, even though, you know, many of our schools, or at least some of our schools, are not doing all of the things that you would hope for. And some of them are in pretty high prevalence areas. But, you know, in the schools that are doing more distancing and masking, the rates are really low. So, you know, well under 1 in 1,000 kids over a 2-week period. So in a school of, you know, maybe 1,200 kids, you'd expect maybe one case over every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you feel it's safe to open them back up.
I think that it's complicated. I think a lot of district public schools don't have the kind of resources to do the kind of mitigation that we would like. But I do think people have probably been too cautious about opening, given what we're seeing in schools.
So give me an example of what a properly mitigated school looks like.
So I think a properly mitigated school looks like everyone wearing masks, number one. So staff and student wearing masks, some symptom screening to try to keep people from coming to school when they're sick. Some kind of distancing, probably, although, we're seeing a lot of schools that are doing just 3 feet. And I think that, you know, maybe
3 feet,
maybe 3 feet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that's showing up in the data as predictive of low case rates is limiting the group sizes. So some schools, we ask schools if they have if they allow groups of more than 25, and having limited group sizes seems to matter. Almost no school is doing any testing, even the private schools in our data.
Really? Okay. So testing, what, just because of the expense?
Yeah, because it's very expensive. It's not super available.
What about teachers? Did teachers feel confident in being in front of a classroom of, you know, potentially asymptomatic but infectious kids?
Yeah, so I think teachers are very anxious about this. But one of the things that I think we're starting to see in the data, I think it's really important to emphasize, you know, we do collect information on staff infection rates. They are higher than students, although they are still quite low, maybe 0.25%. But what we're seeing is that there are a number of school districts where the staff is in person and the students are not. And those districts are seeing infections that look very similar to places where the students are in person.
Really?
Yeah. So it looks, I think it's consistent with what other people have noted, that a lot of the risks to staff are interactions with other staff. And So we want to be a little bit careful. I think sometimes people get the false sense of security that, oh, if I'm not interacting with the students, it's safe. But it's actually the other adults that are sort of the biggest risks to people.
Well, that's good news, though, right? Because presumably staff can be taught to mask up, whereas it's a little more difficult for students. But what you're saying is that student to staff transmission is relatively rare.
That's hard to see from our data because we don't see that directly, but that would certainly be one inference. And I think in other settings we have seen, when the people have looked at, say, childcare settings, the staff to staff transmission seems to be the biggest piece of this. And I think you're right that it should in some ways make people feel more confident, because I don't think that's the thing most people are worried about. And it is also feels like it should be able to be prevented by, say, wearing a mask all the time and not having lunch together in an indoor lunchroom.
Now, are we pretty much talking about airborne transmission now, or is touching an infected surface still considered a thing?
My sense of the data on this is that we are most concerned at this point about airborne transmission, yeah, and that the sort of surface transmission piece of this seems like it's somewhat less important than we might have thought in April.
Yeah. All right. So then it sounds to me like you feel it is practical to reopen schools, even if you don't do daily testing. Let me ask you this. Why are younger students less infectious, and do they get more dangerous the older they get? In other words, is it safer to open up an elementary school than a high school?
We're definitely seeing in the data that the rates are lower in elementary schools. And I think that that is consistent with the sort of general impression that we have gotten from the data that younger students are less likely to be infected, and probably that they're less likely to transmit, although the data on that is less consistent than the data on infection rates. The other thing is, you know, elementary schools are just much easier to manage in the kind of ways that would be safe. So the keeping everyone in one classroom, not having them interact with a lot of other students outside, I think that's much easier to do with a 5-year-old than with a 15-year-old.
Okay. So do you have examples of particular districts that you think are doing it right? That, I mean, for example, if somebody listening here in Washington is saying, okay, she makes sense. She is a professor. She goes to Brown University, Ivy League school. We should, I believe her. But I'd like a case study. I'd like a district I could call and check. Can you tell us who's doing it right?
So one of the things we're pretty committed to in the data here is actually not revealing which districts are in here. So we have the data by state, but we have told districts that it's anonymous. You know, I will say that I think this is not talking out of school, because I'm not sure that they're actually in our data, but I spent a bunch of time on the phone with Mason City, Ohio the other day, and everything that they told me sounded like they are doing exactly what they should, running everybody with masks. It's a big school district. They have a lot of kids back full time in person, and they have a very nice dashboard up in which they're tracking themselves, you know, what's going on in their school. So there's an example for people, Mason City.
All right. Sounds good. Emily Oster is an economics professor at Brown University. She is all about the data. You are all about the data, right?
I am all about the data.
Okay. And you have a national COVID-19 school response data dashboard. I assume you can Google that and it'll come right
COVID,
up.
Right? Try COVIDschooldashboard.com. You can find us.
COVIDschooldashboard.com. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. One day you're shopping at IKEA. The next, you're making every cat and dog in shelters in two states comfortable. KNBC reporter Alan Shope in Mission, Kansas, has the story.
First thing that came to mind for me was these would be perfect for animal shelters.
Well-known KC animal advocate Scott Poor is talking about a recent trip to IKEA where the idea was laying right in front of him.
It's the perfect size for a bed for a dog or a cat.
The foamy bathroom floor mat, a popular item, since Scott has already been able to supply all the shelters in the Kansas City area. Now he's thinking bigger.
And I want to do it for the entire state of Kansas and the entire state of Missouri.
It's a $25,000 goal Scott set out to hit before the holiday. Less than a week in, and he's already more than halfway there.
We're going to start with some of the smallest, most rural organizations.
IKEA says when Scott approached them about using the floor mats as dog beds, they loved the idea.
We thought it was very creative, and that's just the outside-of-the-box thinking that we really appreciate.
Scott says it's all about helping the animals that need the beds the most.
This is an incredibly comfortable thing for an animal to sleep on, and most of these animals are coming from living on the streets.
Scott adds 100% of the money raised will go towards getting shelters the soft beds.
Ooh, watching that video of those cats and dogs in cages. I fear the day I walk into a shelter to adopt an animal. Mm. I don't know if I'll be able to leave with just one.
And you come out with like 10 of them. Yeah.
Exactly. Shh, don't tell my husband.
Now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here is G. Scott. Did you watch the president last night?
I did. I think everybody else in America did too.
Okay, and so the question I put out this morning, asking for magic messages, was how do you think he looked last night? And Colleen, read a few of these, would you?
Oh, sure. Yes, the magic messages are pouring in. Small sample, definitely trying to hold back big breaths. Never can tell his true skin color because of very tan makeup. Another person wrote, not 20 years younger, but definitely not defeated. Trump, the people's champion. The next one, the Prez is on steroids. No wonder he feels 20 years younger. You guys ever taken steroids for an illness?
Yeah.
It's so true. You feel like you can lift a car.
Yeah, but don't try it. So, G, what did you think?
Thanks for the advice, Dave.
Well, I thought that it was par for the course. I think that he's a prideful man. He is someone, and all of us in some way, shape, or form, when we don't, even if we're really sick, sometimes some of us don't want to let on to how sick that we are. And in his case, knowing that he is on a certain type of steroid, he reminds me of some friends that I know in my lifetime that have taken steroids, and they say the same thing. Like you guys said, you feel 20 years younger in those situations. And, you know, right now, also when I see him, President Trump reminds me right now of that one friend or family member that we talk to. It's at the end of the night. They've had a little bit too much to drink. And you're like, hey, let me get your keys. Hey, you know what? I don't think you should maybe do this. Do you know how stubborn those folks can be?
Yeah.
From time to time? I mean, so stubborn. Like, you can't tell them anything. I think this is what's happening right now with the president. I believe that there are people probably in this corner or in his cabinet that are saying, hey, president, can you kind of calm down a little bit? Can you not do this? And this is a situation where you can't tell the man anything. He's going to do what he wants to.
I mean,
and by the way, he's got some stuff inside of him that's making him feel invincible.
Right. But this is what happens with presidents, is that they have to show the nation that they are strong and that their leader is going to be there for them. You think about presidents in the past who have hidden their illnesses and ailments. It's a historic thing. It just happens to fall in line with other fibs that the president has told before. It's to be expected from this president. Mm-hmm. The sad thing to me is, say everything is true about his health and that his doctors are telling the truth. Let's just say for a minute everything is the truth. That lines up with what we expect from COVID. Some people do better than others, and maybe President Trump is somebody who just does better. But the advice should still be to be cautious and careful. That's the concerning part about this.
No, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Like, again, I started this off. I really don't have a problem with him wanting to show the world that, hey, I'm strong and, hey, I'm getting through this and all those. That's fine. But it is reckless to get on there and to tell the American people to not be worried about COVID. It is reckless to tell us that, considering that 210,000 Americans are dead, considering that people that are still here when their loved ones are gone, how does that make them feel? How does that make my aunt feel who, when my cousin passed away and she wasn't even allowed to go and see her baby in that hospital? You see, when you say those things, that's wrong. I have no problem with the way that you want to appear. It is what you are saying now that is just not good.
G and Ursula, 9 o'clock in Kai Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, guys.
That listener said he is a living, talk about the president, he's a living Rorschach inkblot. You see what you want. Which is certainly, boy, watching the coverage last night, scanning across the channels, it covered the spectrum. Let's go to Washington, D.C., Washington Post Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold. Well, David, what a day yesterday. So I think we all know that the president's treatment was pretty much patient-driven. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it was extraordinary in a couple of ways. It was extraordinary, yes, because he seems to have dictated the pace of when he, you know, would go out on visits and when he would need to leave the hospital, but also because he got a lot of medicines that the average person doesn't get. One of these things, I think he's one of less than 10 people in the country to get this particular therapy.
So that, I don't know, that strikes me as a pretty gutsy move, don't you think?
Yeah, it made me wonder, like, if it works this well, I mean, if he really is better now and is not cruising for a collapse, like, why have only 10 people gotten that? I think everybody who needs it should get it.
No, exactly. So how do you feel about the issue of whether his physician was completely frank about his condition or not?
I think it's important. I mean, I think there's two issues here. One, if the president's physician had just said, look, there's a lot of things I can't tell you, that would be bad in some ways because he's the leader of our country. We need to know if he's got his faculties, if he's actually able to lead the country right now, or if he's, you know, incapacitated. But he didn't just do that. He actually lied. The White House physician actually lied about whether the president had had supplemental oxygen and then admitted the next day that he had lied. We can't have somebody like that lying to us. You know, you can't, if you don't want to talk about it, don't talk about it. But there's a position of trust there when you're the president's physician speaking to the country. Don't lie to us.
Well, now, I think now in the first administration of oxygen, didn't they say that it was for about 60 seconds before his oxygen level came right back up to where it should be, and they sort of continued it as a precaution, but it didn't sound like it was a major administration of oxygen.
But that's, I mean, what he said was the president didn't have any oxygen yesterday, and I think that was untrue. I mean, if you think it's not a big deal, say it's not a big deal, or just don't talk about it, but don't tell me something that's not true.
I think, you know, I've come to the conclusion it's a generational thing, because I'm mid-baby boom, he's early baby boom. We were used to presidents always lying about their medical conditions. We found that Kennedy lied about his medical condition. Nixon, I mean, we didn't know he was on his knees praying to portraits and stuff like that until later. Jimmy Carter was the first president I recall being brutally honest about his hemorrhoids, and that became a big subject of ridicule. So, you know, I can see why someone in that position doesn't want to betray the fact that he might, in fact, not be up to making a decision in public while making sure in private that he's got backup. Isn't that reasonable to think?
Like I said, that supports the theory of you just don't talk about it. If the president's, you know, just don't answer questions about the president's health. But if you're the president's doctor and you come out to address the country and you lie about it, and then the next day you admit that you lied about it, any credibility you have is gone. Like, it doesn't matter what you say after that. You could say President Trump is up doing cartwheels. No one's going to believe you because you've already told us you lied. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's one thing for people to just not release information, but to say something that's categorically not true, I just feel like, you know, you destroy the public's trust. Like, anyone going to trust what that guy says about Trump's health again?
Yeah, possibly. But is that fair to him? Let me ask you this. The guy's a Navy doctor, right?
Yeah.
He holds a rank in the Navy. So his commander-in-chief tells him what to say, right? I mean, or should he have said, sir, that's an unlawful order. I'm going to reveal your blood pressure, whether you like it or not.
Well, he's free not to say anything. He's free not to have press conferences.
He tried that, but the reporters kept badgering him to say something.
Nobody told him to lie. I mean, nobody on our side. None of the media said, hey, come out and tell us something, even if it's not true. If Trump's telling him, look, don't reveal these unflattering facts, that's fine. I mean, I guess that's up to him and his chain of command. But, you know, there's nothing that justifies lying, both morally and also just if he wants to be believed. I mean, the reason the president sends him out there is because people believe this guy. He's got the big presidential seal on his medical coat. And if you want to have that position of authority, you destroy that authority in a second if you lie.
Yeah. Okay, the other big issue, contact tracing. Apparently the White House is not doing it. Is it your conclusion that it was the Amy Coney Barrett Rose Garden event that was the cause that for the spread among the White House staff?
It seems like that was at least an important event for spread to some people. I mean, there were the president of Notre Dame, a couple of senators. There were some other folks who were at that event. That was like their only time at the White House. It seems like they must have gotten it then. But, you know, it seems like somebody at the White House had it before then or could have had it before then. So I don't think that everybody we're hearing about now that has this got it at the Amy Coney Barrett event. But I do believe the spread within that sort of Republican White House world certainly accelerated at that event.
I was looking at something,
which was extremely stupid, by the way. I told everybody, they gave them these quickie, not very reliable tests, and when they passed the test, they said, just take your mask off, act like it's 2019,
yeah,
which is a terrible idea in any circumstance.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. I look at some of the interactive newspaper coverage of it, and it was like, you know, they would highlight the people who were there, their locations. It's like reading an Agatha Christie novel, like a whodunit. I mean, so there's not going to be any attempt then to find out how the president got infected?
I guess not. You know, we are trying to do, you know, and a lot of other news organizations are trying to figure out how widely this spread and where it began. I mean, but it doesn't seem like the White House cares, which is crazy because it seems like, you know, maybe he's spreading it to other people. I mean, just to give you a sense of how wide this is, like, we had to pull our daughter out of a soccer match because of some contamination on the soccer team that began at the White House.
What?
So, like, that this spread. So, like, our daughter, we pulled her off her soccer team because somebody on her soccer team may have been exposed to somebody who's exposed to Trump. So,
seriously? Wow.
Yeah.
How far is the exposure in the West Wing gone? Are there still going to be more shoes to drop here?
This morning the White House announced, or somebody reported, that another White House valet has it. There's two White House staff that have it, in addition to, you know, a New York Times reporter, and now the New York Times reporter's wife has it. So this is spreading, and I think the worst part is, because they're not doing contact tracing, there are a lot of people out there who may be asymptomatic or pre-symptomic who are spreading it now and don't even know, because there's been no effort to warn them.
So what are the reporters doing? The reporters are hanging around there all the time.
Oh, my God. There was a picture, a video this morning taken by one of our photographers in the White House press offices, of a guy, a White House employee, in a hazmat suit, like total head-to-toe Tyvek suit with like some spray of like a backpack that was spraying some sort of, I don't even know what, like mist in the air that was supposed to kill the coronavirus. So that's what these people are working in. They're wearing their regular clothes, and there's another guy in a hazmat suit spraying them with mist.
Actually, you know, that's not crazy, because, I mean, the White House press, the West Wing is as cramped as it gets. I mean, the place is tiny, and they're all crammed in there. So, yeah, I guess that's become a high-risk job at this point. So, politically, how do you think this plays politically? He's clearly trying to cast himself in the hero role, the man who stood strong against the virus and beat it. Is that going to work?
I don't think so. I mean, the polls that I've seen for him over the last few days that have happened since he got infected, there was one out of Pennsylvania this morning and the national poll from CNN, have been terrible for the president. You know, I think he's trying to say, look, I overcame the virus, you know, which I hope is true. And I hope that continues to be, that he gets over this and we don't have to worry about his health. But like, he got it by being reckless. And I think there's not a lot of public respect or reward from the public for somebody who is like bragging about the fact that he gave himself a disease that they're all trying to avoid. I just don't see a bump for him out of that.
Well, did he give it to himself? I mean, somebody around him was running around unmasked and gave it to him, right? I mean, the mask is supposed to stop you from giving it to other people. So they should find out who was running around unmasked and aerosoled in his direction.
I mean, I agree. But Trump, if you look at Trump and his family and his inner circle, they all took these incredible risks that made no sense. The risks that Trump's own CDC was telling none of us to take, you know, having gatherings indoors unmasked, gathering big groups of people inside for any reason. They were courting that for that risk for so long. And then Trump got it. So, yeah, we don't know who gave it to Trump, but he should have understood the risk. We've all known the risk for 7 months, and should have understood what to do so he wouldn't get it. And he just ignored all that and wound up with his disease.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. Someday we'll get back to the tax returns, David, but I don't think it's going to
be someday. You can ring my
bell, Rachel Bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, Chris Sullivan. And here's Rachel Bell, because an amazing thing has happened. Bookstores, which were decimated by Amazon, are now making a comeback because of COVID. Is that what you found?
That's right. It took a pandemic to get people reading again.
Yes.
Yay! This article was in the Wall Street Journal, and the question that was asked is, can books compete with Netflix? And the answer was yes. So in August 2020, year-over-year sales of print books in the U.S. were up 13% compared to last year. And it seems like what people are saying is, you know, I'm tired of looking at screens. I'm working from home, so I'm on Zoom talking with my friends. I'm reading the news because I'm worried about things like the election. So I don't want to watch TV and movies as much as I did. I want to just look at a book.
I don't know why that should be, because actually I don't think I am working any less for being stuck at home here.
Yeah.
If anything, I feel like I'm on call all the time. And yeah, I'm trying to count. I've read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 books in September.
Books in September alone?
Yeah, just because it's so convenient to have it right there, and you can go from work right to the reading chair. I read in ferry lines like people get used to in Seattle. But I've also binge watched Bleep Creek on Netflix too. So
you're just not sleeping. You're just consuming media 24 hours a day.
I'm also sleeping because I end up taking a nap. So maybe the commute sucked up more time than I really thought.
Another thing that they credit is indie bookstores during all this, because those were the guys that were, you know, not doing very well. But small independent bookstores have been doing a lot of cool things. First of all, a lot of free shipping, which I know was true here in Seattle at my favorite all cookbook bookstore, Book Larder in Fremont, which is an amazing shop if you love food. They've since stopped that, but for, you know, at least 6 months, free shipping. And then a lot of these indie bookstores are just doing these cool deals. So I'll give you a couple of examples. There is a bookstore in Tulsa, Oklahoma called Magic City. City Books. And if you give them $55 for their literary care package, you fill out a form that you say what kind of type of book that you like to read, and then they will send you a surprise package that they've custom picked based on your taste. And then another bookstore, this is the Novel Neighbor in Webster Groves. Oh my gosh, I feel like such a dum-dum. What is MO? Missouri?
Missouri, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Woo! So they will send you this mystery box as well, but you get like special other goodies in there that are kind of themed with the books that you pick. Oh, I like this one. At Kramer Books and Afterwards Cafe in Washington, D.C., you can order, if you order a book on Postmates, you can also order food from them. So you can get a delivery of,
I love that,
like a grilled cheese sandwich and a novel at the same time. So you said you've read a ton of books. What would be, if people are listening in there, like, I want to be as smart as Dave Ross. It's like every year Bill Gates releases his top picks. What is one of your favorites?
Well, I know what their top picks, but the ones I happen to read. Planet Funny, that was Ken Jennings' book. Geography of Genius, Democracy in One Book or Less, David Letty, worked for the Obama administration. I speed read Mary Trump's book on the Kindle.
Now you're just bragging.
Julian Barnes' Noise of Time, which is about Dmitri Shostakovich, which was surprisingly interesting. Steve Martin wrote a book called Object of Beauty about the art world, which I also thought was fascinating.
I loved his book Shop Girl, which came out now like 15 years
ago.
Yeah,
well, this is the first Steve Martin book I read. The other Einstein about his wife, who apparently actually invented the theory of relativity. So there you go. I'm coping well, I guess.
You sure are. I will say my favorite is one that's a lot of people's favorite, so I almost feel like so basic, Pumpkin Spice Latte, for loving it. But Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens is worth all of the hype. I couldn't put it down. Actually, I forced myself to put it down because I didn't want it to go so quickly. So I started reading two other books so I could prolong it. And so I'm still finishing The Diary of Anne Frank, which I picked up, which I highly recommend rereading while in quarantine because it really puts things into perspective.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.